morning on Tell Somebody, former FBI whistleblower Colleen Rowley returns to the show. Stand by for Tell Somebody. Hello and welcome to Tell Somebody, July 3rd, 2014, www.tellsomebody.us, on Twitter, at Tell Somebody Now. Look for Tell Somebody Now on Facebook. This is your host, Tom Clammer. If you have any comments or questions on the show, drop me a line at mail@tellsomebody.us. We've been checking in on Tell Somebody with Colleen Rowley from time to time ever since I first met her at the 2008 National Media Reform Conference in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Colleen Rowley is a former FBI agent and whistleblower and was a Democratic, or as they do it in Minnesota, a Democratic Farmer Labor Party candidate for Congress in Minnesota's 2nd Congressional District in 2006. Rowley became an FBI agent after receiving a law degree from the University of Iowa College of Law in 1980. Shortly after becoming a special agent with the FBI, Rowley was assigned to the Omaha, Nebraska and Jackson, Mississippi divisions, and she spent 6 years working in the New York field office on investigations involving organized crime. She also served in the U.S. Embassy in Paris and the consulate in Montreal. In 1990, she was assigned to the FBI's Minneapolis field office, where she became the chief legal advisor. After the September 11, 2001 attacks, Rowley wrote a paper for FBI Director Robert Mueller documenting how FBI headquarters personnel in Washington, D.C. had mishandled and failed to take action on information provided by the Minneapolis field office regarding its investigation of suspected terrorist Zacharias Moussaoui. Failures identified by Rowley may have left the U.S. vulnerable to the September 11, 2001 attacks. Rowley testified in front of the Senate for the 9/11 Commission about the FBI's internal organization and mishandling of information related to the 9/11 attacks. Rowley jointly held the Time Magazine Person of the Year Award in 2002 with two other women credited as whistleblowers. And in 2002, she also received the first Sam Adams Award given annually to an intelligence professional who has taken a stand for integrity and ethics. And, along with former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, attorney and whistleblower Jesselyn Radack, and NSA whistleblower Thomas Drake, she traveled to Moscow last fall to present the 2013 Sam Adams Award in person to NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. I got on the phone with Rowley and recorded this conversation. Give a listen. Colleen Rowley, welcome back to Tell Somebody.
Well, thanks for having me.
So I understand you had a visitor from Washington, D.C. last week in Minneapolis. Did he come to seek your counsel on foreign affairs or something?
Actually, that would have been nice. We desperately did try to message Obama, And I apparently Nancy Pelosi as well. There were quite a number of high-ranking figures that came for a Democratic Party fundraiser, a big money fundraiser. I think that was the real reason they came. You had to pay, I think, $32,000 to have dinner and your picture with Obama. And because, you know, I think, you know, legalistically that they have to have a reason for coming in order to fly Air Force One and put all the security on the taxpayer's dime. So you can't say you're coming just for a political fundraiser. So since he was coming already for that political fundraiser, they did a stage town hall, and it's kind of a contradiction of terms because the town hall is only by people they specially invite to ask staged questions, etc. So they had one of these stage town halls where they bus the people in. That was in a public park, Minnehaha Park, in the afternoon. He also had this thing staged with a woman who had written a letter about how hard it is, the middle class life, and so he spent an hour with her and ate at a restaurant that's one of the icons and got the favorite cheeseburger that people know of. I mean, these things are all, you know, the PR departments at work overtime trying to put these things together. And so then the next day, the same woman who had written the letter and then had the dinner or the lunch with Obama then introduces him to something that was actually more of a public event. You had to stand in line to get tickets, and a couple thousand people stood in line for several hours and got tickets to a different park that's on one of our lakes. And then he gave his final speech was on the economy and how it's picking up, and it's, you know, basically to show that he's compassionate for the middle class and the people who are struggling. So that was the final speech. So when we learned of these things, and actually we didn't know about those town hall parts of it until later, the first thing we knew about was the political fundraiser, because that had been advertised or there had been an article about it. So we decided to, with our banners, and I posted these on Facebook. We had quite a few creative banners that we've been using even for the first Iraq War, so now we can pull them all out again and use them again. And we went to this fundraiser. They had not, the police, you know, because there's basically hundreds of sheriffs and city police, and then also the Secret Service. There was a helicopter that kept coming up and down, flying right over the trees. Probably Homeland Security. I mean, they've got several different federal canine officers we saw with dogs. So we saw hundreds of officers guarding this town. It was a development of mansions really close to the Mississippi River. And so each of this development, they said, was private, which I don't know. Normally it's public. You know, cars can drive through. But they closed down this development of mansions that was holding the fundraiser. Well, but we got there at 3:00 in the afternoon, and it was for dinner that night, and they hadn't closed it down yet. So we went right through in our car and saw the people that were holding the fundraiser. If I had been thinking more, I would have yelled out the window, "Tell Obama not to start a third war with Iraq," which would have been our big opportunity to get a message. But when I saw them out walking their dog, I didn't think fast enough. So then we got pushed out of that development. But they hadn't thought ahead of time about where the so-called free speech area was going to be. So we went to the beginning of where the development starts, and that's where we knew the motorcade would have to come through. Well, eventually they decided that was too close. We couldn't be right there at the start of the development or the entrance to the development. So then I said, well, what about this little park? There's a little park right alongside the Mississippi that was a half a block from the entrance to the development. And so we had about 80 people or so of different groups with our signs and banners. One group was against deportation. They were for easing of immigration. There was another group that was against the pipelines, the Keystone Pipeline, and there's another pipeline they're building through Minnesota. And then our group, which was anti-war and anti-torture. And so we all kind of combined and took turns chanting and holding up our banners. And that motorcade could see us when they came by. In fact, some of the people I was with, Vets for Peace, for instance, who had gone out to D.C., said, well, this is the closest we've ever gotten to Obama. Even though we traveled, you know, we went in a carpool all the way out to D.C. a few times, we've never gotten this close before. So in the sense that we got, we were able probably, if somebody happened to be looking, we were able to get our message, you know, not to start the Iraq war. And we had a banner close Guantanamo, and I had one that said was Iraq Nam in the war. So that, of course, is a message about how this is, I think, even worse than the Vietnam quagmire at this point. So that's what we did, and unfortunately, our news, actually two of our TV channels came, and they filmed this for a couple hours, but it was like maybe 20 seconds aired on one of the channels.
Right.
You just do what you can, because the problem right now, I gave another interview earlier this morning, it's a frustrating thing without a democratic representation way of course, where 65-70% of the American public does not want a new war to start. I mean, when they do the polls, it's a large majority of people. And yet, almost no way to get through to Congress, and certainly very little way to get through to the executive branch. And so it's a frustrating thing. And you can make all these calls and talk to the comment line, and you can write letters to the editor, and do what you can, you know, try to reach a motorcade now and then. It's just we keep thinking of what we can try to do, but it's not easy. We're not in the normal times where democracy should work a little better than this.
Well, I was going to ask, how effective do you think this bannering and so forth is? I mean, I think we have some pretty solid evidence that when the numbers were huge, and Nixon and LBJ could look out White House windows and hear this stuff, that it did have an effect on their decision-making. But we don't seem to have the numbers these days. And whatever faults the media had back then, they weren't quite the cheerleaders for war like they are today, are they?
Yeah, I mean, the complexion of the country has changed, and it is, rooted in the social control mechanisms that are lessons learned from Vietnam. You know, one of the main things, were the main lessons learned from Vietnam, certainly by the military-industrial complex, but, by people who want war to be launched and want it to keep going, is to end the draft. The draft, you know, Vietnam had a graph showing people were for the war starting off, and very unlike the Iraq war, where people were against the war starting off, except on the eve, then they switched back and they were for it for a very short period of time. But in Vietnam, they were for it, you know, when it started. Yeah, we got to get them, Gulf of Tonkin. And then slowly the opposition to the Vietnam War climbed. And it climbed because of the draft and because of these American casualties. And it also climbed because, the costs of war were very apparent. Eventually your media, people like Walter Cronkite, went on and said, you know, folks, I'm going to level with you. Vietnam War is unwinnable. And he had the trust. I mean, the media now is all fractured in a million different things. And so somebody like Brian Williams, you know, doesn't even begin to approach the credibility and trust that somebody like Walter Cronkite had at the time. And the news was showing the photos of the little girl running that had been napalmed. That isn't happening now with the plan to embed the media with the troops to get them to align with the military and stuff. That never happened. You never really had the media being aggressive and showing the truth. So just listen to the chicken hawks like Dick Cheney and Karl Rove, 11 draft deferments, who all the neocons, by the way, Robert Kagan, who call themselves military historians, Max Boot, who characterizes himself as a military strategist. These neocon military strategists are chicken hawks, are bigger chicken hawks than Karl Rove. Not a one of them has military experience. And so this is who are leading. These are the people writing and leading, and they write these strategic articles about the United States gaining control, et cetera. Well, none of them have any military experience, and that's who's leading the crowd here. So yeah. You get into this situation that we're in right now, which is probably, you know, the perfect storm for continuing a perpetual, endless war. It's impossible. Even people who are in peace groups are becoming pretty frustrated because they'll say, how do you get the American people to care? It's not at all the same as Vietnam, where people naturally cared because Americans were dying. Then the drone, the use of drones, which are America right now, temporarily until other countries can get up to speed, right now it is casualty-free for the American side. So the use of drones, you know, if they start that in, they already are using surveillance drones in Iraq, and it's just probably a question of time before they would start using the drones to they'll tell us surgically bomb, which is impossible. And how can Americans care? How can, because it's only killing other people. It's impossible. It's only, you know, so that's, this type of situation, again, these are very smart people. And they've recognized if you want to keep a war going past whatever it is now, 12 years into 13, and what John McCain said is going to be a long war. He used the term long war, and he also, when he was running against Obama in 2008, said the war will go on for another 100 years. Because we even made banners say, not another 100 years. He was very proud, McCain, of saying that this war will never end. It will go on for 100 years. So it's a sad situation. Now, to counter that, I think you do have to try to explain the costs, even though they're hidden and they're difficult for Americans to see. There is right already a lot of blowback. And there are costs that are catching up. The economy has declined. That's all part of this war economy, at least by a third. And that's going to, you know, weaken the United States when the economy declines. That's one thing. I think a lot of the school shootings, there's school shootings at least one or two a week. You know, people say, well, that has nothing to do with the war. Well, it sure does. There's very few people connecting this militarism over, you know, pervasive militaristic culture that, you know, we exist in right now with the domestic violence and terrorism, domestic terrorism that the United States is suffering on a really, really high scale. You know, Europe and Norway and Canada do not have this problem. Well, what's the reason for it? Why does the United States have this terrible escalating domestic violence? So anyways, there are costs. It's just that people are not able to see those costs of war. And I think that's the answer, is to make them understand that they, it's actually one of the big inputs, I think, or the big effects of Snowden's disclosures. Which were finally then to reveal that the American public is also targeted, because the public has been led to believe we fight them over there to keep them from fighting here, that, you know, we may have to kill foreign people, you know, somewhat less than human foreign people, you know, people that are less civilized than us, etc. But it doesn't, there's no blowback on us. Well, when they realize that they are being surveilled and that their information, private information, is being vacuumed up, that really, I think, just mentally changes the picture for a lot of people. I think that's one of the reasons why we probably now have a high majority of people in the United States that don't want any more war, because they realize that this pervasive surveillance on themselves is one of the underlying pillars of the so-called war on terror.
Yeah, and so much of this, in my mind, comes back to the media. The media had no holding to account for the horrible job they did in informing the public leading up to the shock and awe invasion of Iraq. And now they're trotting out a bunch of the same people that Ambassador Joseph Wilson, thankfully, was on one of the cable news shows on MSNBC.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that, you know, some media is showing the people who were right instead of the people constantly who've been wrong about everything. But you're right, most of the media is guided by this neocon philosophy that the United States is an elite superpower and it has its responsibility to control the world, if necessary, by force, in a kind of almost a policeman of the world function. So it's palatable to many people because they liken it to the domestic situation where police, for instance, will stop a domestic dispute between a husband and wife, and they say, well, someone needs to do that in the world. Let's just keep listening to the neocons because they're the ones paraded out on every Sunday morning talk show, and every op-ed page is full of Robert Kagan saying the United States can't retire from its wars. It's got to take the responsibility of continuing the wars.
Yeah, and I was almost shocked to see, I think it was Megyn Kelly on Fox News, who, you know, generally everything on Fox News is so friendly to the neocons and the Republicans, but she did the best job of anyone I've seen confronting Cheney on saying, you made this mess, and pointing out some particulars. And, you know, even on PBS, Charlie Rose is throwing in softballs.
Yeah. Well, you know why that is? It's because Fox then needs to regain credibility. And so this is a deliberate attempt on Megyn Kelly just to show that she can do the hard, real, professional journalism where you ask hard questions. The partisanship, which is really a problem, because those people who are very much against Bush's wars, that mostly Democrats, who really could spot the problems with Dick Cheney, when that switched around and Obama took over the lead, the great majority of those anti-war Democrats now have become tacitly pro-war. I mean, they did 100, and I know this because in my district, I ran for Congress here, and, you know, most of the people who supported me in 2005 and 2006 were very much against Bush's wars. But these many years later, under Obama, most of them have just gone along. In fact, they don't even talk much about the police state and the NSA. Very few of the Democratic loyalists talk about it. So it's the Republican side who is criticizing the NSA spying and the Liberty situation. They're actually the strongest on this right now. It completely turned around. And the only thing that explains that is this partisanship, political party partisanship that people it's a simplistic way of governing yourself without being loyal to the principle. You're loyal to a person or to your group. And it works. I mean, Karl Rove well knows how this works. All of these political strategists know that this works so well. You divide and conquer and split the country into two parties, and they each believe that the other party is the problem. And meanwhile, the issues, and I would say at least three main issues of the wars, the police state type things, the civil liberties, and the corruption, government corruption. Enormous agreement between people. If you get away from the partisanship, there is enormous agreement amongst Republicans, Democrats, Libertarians, Greens. Everyone agrees on those three things. But you would never know it because these parties then split that consensus right up. And as soon as the consensus is split up, the people who are for the corruption, who are for the authoritarian police state, they are happy because now they get to do what they want because you've got people already split up into small groups. The answer is to unify. And so with Snowden's disclosures, there are at least 30 civil liberties groups, and they do span right and left, which is really good when you see the trying to think of what the group is. There's one group called Campaign for Liberty is one. There's another group that's working on the local level, PANDA. It's called People Against the NDA, the NDAA, Indefinite Detention, and that's a libertarian kind of more on the right group. There's about four or five groups, but anyways, it's a mixture of right and left. Well, that's what you want. That's exactly what you want, to unify on an issue. You don't want to just be within one side of this, because that's inherently not going to work. You know, you're already split in half that way.
Yeah, you sort of suggested that this politics of personality is just folly. I mean, when I look at Supreme Court decisions, I think I'm glad Obama is president rather than McCain or Romney or somebody like that. But on so many other issues, what's the difference? Obama has continued so much of the Bush policies, and in terms of drones and persecuting whistleblowers, he's even worse. And I think you've written something recently about Elizabeth Warren. I love what she's doing in terms of wanting to rein in Wall Street and make reforms in that area, but I don't want to wed myself to this personality blindly on everything, because she's also found it politically expedient to embrace AIPAC. So I want to support the Wall Street reforms. I don't want to put Elizabeth Warren or anybody else on a pedestal and worship them.
Yeah, that's the thing, is blind partisanship is really dumb. Jefferson said the bedrock of democracy rests upon informed citizenry. And this whole party partisanship or identity politics where, you know, the newest thought is a woman. We have to have a female president. Well, Hillary Clinton is a war hawk feminist. You know, she, along with Madeleine Albright and Susan Rice and Samantha Power, they're responsible for even launching wars. They even argued with the men. They even, Gates didn't want to bomb Libya. It was Hillary Clinton who prevailed. So if you were one of these people who thought Bush's wars were terrible, why would you be pushing now for Hillary Clinton? And she's not even, I would say that she's not even a lesser evil. To be honest, I can't imagine even McCain. She is very close with McCain, by the way, very, very close. They're two peas in a pod. There's no way that you would even say that Romney, McCain, somebody that you think is the greater evil is greater. That's not true at all. But yet, identity politics works because people have this idea, oh, women, they're the softer sex, and, you know, women, the feminist movement, we need women in positions of power because they'll be better than the men. That actually is this old belief, progressive belief, that women will somehow be able to end wars because they're mothers, etc. Condi Rice, Susan Rice, black females, and I would throw in maybe Colin Powell, the black male. This was believed that they're minorities, and when they're going to get power, they're going to somehow have a Martin Luther King Jr. moment where they will recognize that that they're going to be fairer and more equitable, etc. Not true at all. Not true at all. I mean, I see the split right now as realist, fact-based, and versus this neocon idealism, which is not fact-based at all. I mean, history doesn't matter, and future consequences don't matter. It's just whatever we write and, projecting power. And Hillary Clinton is definitely part of this, is a real odd idealist, utopian, positing a utopian outcome, and then saying, yes, but we have to use these awful means. And her track record and voting record is just awful. And so that's, people got to think. They really got to use their brains right now instead of their heartstrings or their emotional loyalties. And they really, it's just like a scientist, you know, a scientist may have some theory about how an experiment will come out, and they may hope that a drug will work. If they're testing a drug, that's, you know, trying to deal with some serious illness, they may have hopes that something can work, and they might be biased in some way. They may think that, you know, it worked on rats, it should work on humans. I mean, they may have a... But a scientist has to keep an open mind and a critical thinking ability. Because if the experiment doesn't bolster their theory, then they've got to be... And, of course, even scientists fail at this sometimes. We have scientists that do experiments, and they just can't accept that their theory was wrong, and they skew their data in order to try to prove their theory. And if there's a financial incentive that they're getting some money from a drug, well then, yeah, really you have to be cynical about their experiment, because even scientists and doctors can become corrupted if they're able to make money off of something. But it's a very much the same situation with these issues of right and wrong, you know, on launching preemptive war and torture and a massive surveillance of Americans that violates the Constitution, etc. These things are so, so wrong. And for people to now be convinced that because Hillary says it's okay, Hillary or Obama says it's fine, and then to go along with it and make up excuses and rationales why it's fine and good, it's rather mind-boggling. And it just shows you how easy... The media, of course, is a huge part of this, because the only thing that the people have to get informed is the media. They had this idea that they were the fourth estate and that they would challenge power. Megyn Kelly, I didn't see the interview that you're talking about with Megyn Kelly and Dick Cheney, but good for her if she did challenge Dick Cheney. But that's the assumption that we had. We had the assumption that journalists are going to be like Walter Cronkite and going to be in it. That's why they became journalists, for the truth. That's no longer the case. They're in it for the money. They're in it to curry favor, to become powerful. It's not just money. These cocktail parties that are in the D.C. Beltway, where like your New York Times editor will go to cocktail parties with all of the main warmongers and drink toast to the U.S., et cetera. I mean, that's problematic for the American public learning the unvarnished truth about what's going on. If we have all of these people that are becoming real cozy, and I'll point to Washington, D.C. as a bubble, because this is where this little center here is occurring.
I'm reminded, I think I heard that Gwen Ifill was a shopping buddy with Condoleezza Rice at the time that she was covering her on the PBS NewsHour, and Condoleezza was selling the Iraq War. I mean, what kind of journalism do you get out of those kind of relationships? Not very good, I suspect.
Nope. The thing with the media at the start of the Iraq War is the assistant, one of the main assistants, public relations, but she was actually, she had a military title. I don't remember what that was Victoria Clark. But she was Donald Rumsfeld's main assistant, and in the lead up to Iraq, she developed this quite audacious plan to embed the media, a 300-page media plan for how the Iraq War would be launched. And before the Iraq War started, when there was a sizable percentage of American populace that was against it, if you just check the polls, like in December 2002, it was still 60-some percent of the American public that was against launching the Iraq War. So they sold it to the American public by going to the media, and it probably was actually one of these dinner parties. But they brought in the top editors, the top people that controlled, you know, some people say there's only about six, because the media now has become so monopolized. You don't have to bring in that many, but the top people, and they told them, here's Victoria Clark's plan. You're going to get embedded this time. It's not going to be like the first Gulf War, where you had to listen to Storm and Norman in a room and write your stories. We're actually going to let you be out there and be embedded. Well, Victoria Clark bragged about this later on. She was giving a speech to this all-women's group, and she was saying, you know, I had to overcome the males that didn't, they were worried about embedding the media. They course, suspicious that there'd be some bad stories that way, etc. So she had this debate internally. She got Rumsfeld on her side, and this was such a innovative thing for her to come up with this media plan. Well, there's two funny things about it. One, there was no plan for Iraq after the shock and awe. There was no plan on how to pacify, what to do afterwards. The only plan, really, that was put in writing was Victoria Clark's plan on how to basically control public opinion through the media. And so, I mean, I guess she was right to brag about herself, but, of course, it was terrible overall for the idea of launching the war based on lies, and then also then this idea that you would only have good stories afterwards through embedded media. But that's how it was done. That's exactly how it was done in starting the first Iraq war, or second Iraq war. And it's worked very well. Of course, by the time you get to 2006 or so, then the public opinion, it took that many years, was eventually then turning against it because some news was getting out.
Yeah.
Now, here we are doing it all over again. The group of neocons that want to launch more war on Syria and Iraq, as well as Ukraine, the Robert Kagan is kind of, right now, I would say he's one of the main leaders of this. They're striving mightily to control the opinion pages. And they do in the Washington Post, which is in D.C. and inside that bubble. Kagan and his ilk really do control the opinion pages in the Washington Post. I don't know that they control throughout, like, you know, middle America where we are as much. But, you know, yet their op-eds are reprinted. They get a lot of play. And then, of course, it's not just Kagan. He's got a whole coterie of other people that, along with him, that are doing the same thing.
Yeah, and like you say, maybe it's not quite as bad in the Midwest, but the papers that have the most influence and the most replay, it doesn't seem like they have to work that hard to influence them. They just do it and somehow the big papers see it in their interest to go that way, too. And, you know, like the New York Times, all the news is fit to print, but what gets most prominently featured? And there was just this article about Blackwater where the headline was very tame about, you know, some report about Blackwater, and then you read into it and you see that a Blackwater official threatened to kill the government overseer if he didn't get out of the way of what they wanted to do.
That's right. That, you know who that article was written by, too, is James Risen.
Right, the one that's being threatened with a prison sentence for not revealing a source. And my understanding is that the government already knows the source. They just want to do this for some kind of retaliation and set an example.
That's right. They want him to testify that this was the source. This was on the first disclosures about massive spying that the New York Times ran after being forced for over a year, and their editor, Bill Keller, going along with Dick Cheney saying, oh, this will be terrible for national security if you tell the American public that the NSA's microphones and vacuum cleaner has been turned on them. And Risen, to his credit, and Lichblau eventually pushed it and were able, over a year later, to publish their article. The reason they were able to do that was Risen wrote a book. Now, that's quite a courageous thing to do when your own editor of the New York Times tells you, let's not tell the American public what the government's doing, and then you go ahead and write a book. I can't remember the name of his book right now, but he writes this book. He also has a chapter in the book about Iran, and the fact is the United States had some horrible idea of giving blueprints for nuclear reaction or whatever to Iran. They were going to give, or they did give, some blueprints, and that in essence this might have even helped Iran. And so it backfired, and it's very embarrassing, of course, to the CIA to be found out that their, you know, one of their crazy plans didn't work and backfired. So that's a chapter in the same Risen book that revealed the surveillance. Well, the person that they're trying now to prosecute as a spy for telling James Risen about this, they believe is the source, and that's why they want Risen to testify. The last thing I've heard is that Risen, they'll probably drop it. You know, they won in the Supreme Court because the Supreme Court refused to take this up, that a whistleblower is different than a spy. If you do get prosecuted for espionage under the old 1917 Espionage Act, you're not allowed to defend yourself by saying, no, I was not, you know, selling this secret to a foreign government. I was trying to give the information to the American public so that they would be able to vote more intelligently and be able to exercise their democratic rights. You can't say that. Chelsea Manning is not allowed to say, no, I was trying to give information about war crimes and the situation to the American public. That you're cut off. You can't at all mount your own defense about your motivations. So if you're accused of being, having violated the Espionage Act of 1917, you just have to sit there while the prosecutor says these things. You can't say, no, of course I'm not a spy. I was not doing these things. They've likened and they've conflated espionage with whistleblowing. And so that was the issue that would have been great to have had the Supreme Court, especially in the Risen case, where you have a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist writing this, that would have been a great issue. But the Supreme Court's makeup right now is pretty awful. As you can see, it's about a 5-4 thing, and they refused to take the case. And so now the government has to decide if they're going to jail James Risen for having written this book back in 2005 or 6, a long time ago. The chance of him being jailed seems to be pretty low because they're building on this. They want to send a signal. Their goal, of course, is to scare all the reporters so that they will never, ever be courageous enough to print something that's this embarrassing to the government that's certainly truthful, doesn't matter. All they care about is this, you know, we don't want you to publish this.
Right.
And so they want to send this message to journalists that you don't do these things. They've achieved that goal. All they had to do was threaten, which they've been doing, to put James Risen in the Pulitzer. So then people, let's say that you do have a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer. Glenn Greenwald, of course, is pushing in the opposite direction. He's trying to say that, no, journalists, you have to be brave and write the truth like I am. But the government's trying to be just the opposite, you know, pushing the other way. And they've pretty much gotten, I think they've achieved their goal. So what they would be doing is probably hurting themselves then to actually punish Risen. Because now some of the media, like New York Times editor, is going to probably say, what? You're actually going to follow through and put our Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist in jail for just doing his job? They may actually antagonize some of these powerful editors. And that would hurt their cause. So the chance, this is just my educated analysis of this, is that they probably won't jail James Risen. But guess what? Anyone else, of course, down the road who doesn't work for New York Times, who might work for a smaller media, who doesn't have that kind of credibility and Pulitzer Prize background, yes, they will then. The next one around that tries to write a truthful story, you know, if McClatchy, writer or whatever, tried to write this, yes, then they're going to be in trouble if they can try to find their sources. And they can easily find sources because they have this ubiquitous surveillance.
Yeah, they've got every email and phone metadata and God knows what.
Yep. So, when you criticize the media, you have to kind of see it from their standpoint.
Sure.
They are really now being, they're walking a tightrope. And for them to even try to publish something is very difficult. If they were really to get a scoop So you do see a lot of editors passing on the real scoops. And the Risen story about Blackwater, did that go back to 2007, I believe?
I'd have to go look. That sounds about right.
I think that it was a killing of 17 people at an intersection. Where
yeah.
Blackwater, of course, they have this idea, well, we just fire in all directions. So as soon as I hear a shot, I just get to spray my gunfire. And they were at an intersection, and they sprayed the gunfire at everybody. And I think 17 Iraqis died, and more, many more were wounded. And there's, as far as I know, never been any accountability for that shooting by Blackwater. What happened, though, was the State Department's own investigators were on the verge of investigating how bad Blackwater's so-called security was and how some of these indiscriminate shootings and killings and stuff were actually hurting the United States' efforts, because obviously you're not going to win hearts and minds by shooting Iraqi civilians. So there was an investigation going on in 2007, right before that intersection shooting. And what happened then was when the State Department itself turned on their own investigators and said, you know, we don't want to make any enemies of Blackwater, for heaven's sakes. And then you're right, there was actually a threat to kill the State Department investigator simply because they would have found out that our mercenary force, Blackwater, was doing wrong things.
Right.
That's how bad. I mean, this was already back in 2007, and we're just learning of it, seven years later. Pretty incredible, pretty incredible. And I don't know, again, things are in the New York Times, but because the American population isn't paying attention to these issues at all, they care about their Super Bowls and their American Idol and Dance with the Stars and reality shows of being put on an island and et cetera, all these crazy things that are the main distraction right now, that it's hard to say what will even come from some of these honest disclosures at this point.
Yeah, and
certainly I don't think it hurt Blackwater. They just changed their name two or three times, and they're still making money as the third version of their, and it's not just Blackwater. They were just the most well-known. There were certainly many other mercenary groups, contractor groups, not been any accountability for the torture contractors so far. Although today, I just posted on our Tackling Torture page, there's an article that a federal judge said that the Abu Ghraib torturers do not get immunity. So whenever you file a lawsuit, the first effort on the part of the government is to say that all the people involved, all the government employees, get full immunity. That's the first tack. And some judge today said that the contractors at Abu Ghraib who tortured are not entitled to immunity. So that was sometimes you see some little good things going in the other direction.
And about time in terms of Abu Ghraib. I remember reading, you know, we've got all this talk now about this ISIS taking over Iraq and you know, all the, as we mentioned earlier, all the people that Joseph Wilson says should be looking out from behind bars in The Hague, making the rounds of the Sunday talk show, saying that we need boots on the ground in Iraq again. But just a week or two ago, I was reading something, an interview with independent journalist Dar Jamail, who did some brilliant work unembedded in Fallujah back around 2005 or so. But he was talking about, and he was last in the area about a year ago, and he was talking about how the Maliki government was sort of forcing an embrace by the public of these ISIS people, and that we, the U.S., had been funding ISIS in Syria and then funding Maliki to fight against him in Iraq, and we're causing the whole mess from the get-go. I mean, apart from the invasion itself, but right in the last year or so, funding both and arming both sides, and now we need to have boots on the ground to go straighten out these belligerent children who don't appreciate the freedoms we gave them.
Well, I've used this line over and over. Haven't we seen this movie before?
Exactly.
Referring to Charlie Wilson's war. And there's other cases besides arming and training the Mujahideen to fight in Afghanistan under the misguided notion that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And so even back during, I can remember, you know, during Charlie Wilson's war, there were broadcasters and journalists saying, we're behind this really backward Mujahideen that are, you know, misogynists and they're terrible with women and they're restrictive. Why are we backing them? And then Charlie Wilson would explain, oh, no, they're fighting our enemy, etc. So we've got to arm them. And this is the roots planted then of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Same thing, there's groups, democracy promotion groups like Wolvey has involved in several of these. Former CIA director Wolvey, he's head of one or involved in one that supported the Chechen separatists. And so you see the same thing happening in Syria where we weren't necessarily doing it so much directly arming, but we were looking aside while Saudi Arabia, our ally Qatar, Saudi Arabia and Turkey were training and arming all kinds of different rebel groups. Well, you know, some of the better, I guess, people in the United States were hoping that they were only arming the so-called good rebels in Syria, the ones that would be loyal to the United States, and not the ones that were more aligned with Al-Qaeda, like al-Nusra and this ISIS group. Well, Borowitz did a real funny, this is definitely worth Googling, but Borowitz did an application for good rebels from Syria, and he's really making fun of this idea that you can pick and choose and that the good rebels won't give their weapons right away to the bad groups that are aligned with terrorists. And, of course, this is pretty common sense. I mean, anybody who would have this notion that you can arm the good rebels and that those arms will not make their way into the group that isn't so loyal to the United States. And now we've created a Frankenstein. I think that the Frankenstein of ISIS could conceivably be far worse than the Frankenstein of Al-Qaeda. There's a great article that says that they're looking, by declaring a caliphate in this area, and they just did this a day ago, and it's pretty risky for ISIS. They risk losing all of their gained territory in Iraq by declaring a caliphate because there will be Sunni and Shiite groups saying, well, who are you to now get control of all of this? And their leader, Baghdadi or whatever is the name of their leader, claimed he's the emir of this caliphate. So there would be quite a number of people like raising their eyebrows and saying, on the other hand, they've actually split from Al-Qaeda, and the Al-Qaeda jihadists of the people like from al-Nusra are now joining in throngs to this ISIS group, saying, well, this is the new... So, my gosh, you know, this is our dream come true, declaring a caliphate in this whole Middle East area. So this just happened a day ago. If the United States falls into the trap now of giving ISIS exactly what it wants, which is a war on the United States, if the United States falls into this and says, you want war, you know, bring it on, that's old Bush's old term, you want war, you new terrorist group, you know, you're only 15,000 warriors, bring it on, we're going to go after you. If that happens, because war is always a two-sided thing, if you get the other side to bait the trap and they take it, you just empowered ISIS. And now you could actually have what everyone has feared all along is this Muslim war with the Muslims, et cetera. The United States has been pretty smart with its public affairs to always disclaim that it was in a war on the Muslim world. well, this will be going against all of the things that they've always strived not to be perceived as doing. So it's real dangerous. It's a very strategic thing. This terrorist group, so-called terrorist group, knows what it's doing. It's actually an offshoot of what Zarqawi, if you remember, Zarqawi in 2006 and 2007 became pretty powerful, and he's the one who then launched the Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Before the U.S. invaded, there was no Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Saddam Hussein was an enemy of the fundamentalist Al-Qaeda, and after they took out Saddam, then Zarqawi rose up, and he got the power, and until he was assassinated, well, this ISIS group is a remnant of that, and now they're much more than a remnant. They're a hydra that has gotten to be quite powerful. But it's absolutely the United States. If you look at how this happened, it was definitely through misguided theories about arming rebels to topple Assad, all of these things that they think they can be so cute about doing, and it doesn't work that way. You know, and it all blows back, and this is what's happened. And it's all about the United States, of course, hoping to control large sections of the Middle East. They're even talking now, of course, about taking out Maliki, because he's a bad, you know, where have we seen this movie before? You know,
right.
Vietnam, take out the first premier and hope that a new one is less corrupt. You're seeing it in the Ukraine. I mean, all this toppling regimes business. And now they're talking about taking out Maliki and putting in, of all people, Ahmad Shalabi, who was the con artist in the first place who led us into the first Iraq war.
You
are a script writer in Hollywood,
Times.
Writing the most far-fetched fiction that you could think of. I mean, you could think of the plots for what's actually happening right now. It's this bad. And these smart neocons, these Max Boots and Robert Kagans, are ridiculously stupid. They're you know, Charlie Wilson, you can just put the whole group in here thinking that they can control things by arming the right, good rebel group that will be loyal to us. Unbelievable. And topple, you know, some people like Saddam Hussein, Gaddafi, and think that this is going to turn out good for the United States. Samantha Power, Hillary Clinton, they're in the thick of it, this idea of thinking that you can topple non-democratic, bring democracy to the world by toppling powerful leaders, and then picking your new powerful leader that's going to be on your side. It is absolutely ludicrous. And it's just going around in a circle right now. And I have a feeling it's going to come back really, it could easily at least come back to seriously bite the United States.
Well, like you said a little while ago, we've seen this movie before. Colleen Rowley, I think we're... The clock has wound down on us, but I'm very glad to hear from you again on Tell Somebody. And any quick final thoughts you want to leave with us? And I think listeners can find some of your Welcome Obama pictures on Facebook. Look for Colleen Rowley. Any other sources of information you'd recommend?
You know, I just want to recommend people do, again, remember to stay critical thinking. Inform yourself. Read a lot. You may not agree with things, but read it anyways. Of course, there's snippets of truth in the mainstream media, so do a lot of reading. But don't let yourself be led by this partisanship. And actually now we do need, as people, just the normal average people, we need to get our neighbors and our families involved. We really have some serious problems that are happening, and it's not going to correct itself. Do not allow your trust and faith in government or politicians now to just guide, oh, well, they know what they're doing. Come on. This is the time when people really have to raise some objection. We were able to stop the Syria bombing plan last fall, and we can do this again to stop this new third war, fourth war, whatever it is on Iraq, but we can't do it unless we can get large numbers of people. So come on, let's get out there, let's write, let's speak, let's get, if we do have a motorcade driving in front of us, let's put out a sign. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you. Hope to talk to you again soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well, that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to the podcast edition of Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us. Comments or questions, send an email to mail@tellsomebody.us. You can also follow me on Twitter @TellSomebodyNow. The Tell Somebody podcast is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the broadcast of Tell Somebody heard on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City, streaming around the world at www.kkfi.org. I'll be on 90.1 FM KKFI every Thursday morning at 9, right after Democracy Now! If you haven't heard Tell Somebody before, I hope you'll listen again. Check out the podcast and the broadcast. Click on a tile at www.tellsomebody.us for a link to a past show. If you enjoyed the show and appreciated the information you got from it, please tell somebody about the podcast and the broadcast. Spread the word to your friends and contacts by word of mouth or Facebook or Twitter or email list or any other way you can think of. This is Tom Clammer. I'll see you next Thursday at 9 a.m. on Tell Somebody or anytime you like at www.tellsomebody.us.